May it please the court.
It does.
My name is Brett Burmeister, and I represent the appellant plaintiff Shannon Baird Gibbons in this case, and Ms. Gibbons is here in the courtroom with me today. Remand is required in this case because the trial court abused its discretion when it permitted an adverse inference against my client after first excluding her from the courtroom. Missouri law is very clear on this issue, and it's reversible error to allow an adverse inference if it's preceded by an exclusionary order. And in fact, the error is so grave that it need not even be preserved for review. Several cases have said it's actually plain error. Now, in this case, it was preserved, so we're under the abuse of discretion standard, but it's such an egregious error that it even rises to that higher plain error standard. On these adverse inference cases, a bright-line rule of sorts has developed. And that bright-line rule is centered around a fact, a single fact. Was the witness excluded by a court order before the adverse inference? If excluded, you can't have an adverse inference. That's Calvin Barnes and Hamels. If the witness is not excluded and still chooses not to testify, then you can't have an adverse inference. That's Burnett and Pasternak. So we have this nice, clean rule. No Missouri court has ever allowed both. No court has said you get your exclusionary order and you get your adverse inference. And that's the problem in this case. The respondent got both. Got both the exclusionary order and got the adverse inference. And this is in direct conflict with this bright-line rule. Now, respondent tries to get around this by stating that my client chose not to testify first, and then the exclusionary order merely enforced that choice. But the record doesn't back that up. In fact, respondent's counsel's own words at trial betray that argument. He says various times throughout the record that he concedes the reason he sought the exclusionary order was that he was concerned my client would decide to come in and testify. Page 169 and 498 are but two examples of that. So even his own words reveal that my client could still come in and decide to testify.
But your client clearly was not in court present when the judge announced the case ready for trial.
That is true. There is no disputing that my client was voluntarily absent from both voir dire and opening statement.
Is it your position that parties can come and go then as they wish during a trial?
Well, I think that certainly a litigant has the right to appear just for her testimony. Now, certainly...
Do you have authority on that?
We don't. We don't have authority on that, but we also don't have authority that says that a party, in order to testify at trial, as a prerequisite to testifying, that you have to be present for voir dire and opening and throughout trial. There's no rule, law, or statute that requires that. And so while we certainly recognize that a trial judge has the inherent authority to control his courtroom and to not let it turn into an atmosphere where parties can do whatever they want in the courtroom, that does not mean that the trial court has the discretion to then allow an adverse inference on top of that. And that's the key. That's the icing on the cake.
What if the adverse inference wasn't mentioned until closing argument?
I think that brings up a very, very good point, a key point in our argument. Truly, an adverse inference is only proper in a closing argument because up until that point, the party asserting that adverse inference wouldn't really know whether or not the party was going to testify or not. It's only if you let the case proceed and see if that party truly voluntarily decides not to show up do you then get that adverse inference. And so that's why, and that created a real problem in this case because in the record you can tell toward the end of the case that Judge Schieber is starting to rethink whether or not the adverse inference was proper. And the problem is it had already been argued in opening statement and we just couldn't unring that bell. And so what really should have happened here is the respondent should have sat back and seen. Maybe she wasn't going to show up and testify. And if she didn't, then approach the bench before closing argument and seek that adverse inference. And Burnett and Pasternak make it very clear that that would have been completely proper. But that's not what happened here. The adverse inference, the exclusionary order was sought and received before opening statements, and the adverse inference was sought and received before opening statements. And it was used, I think, 15 times in opening statement alone and then, of course, throughout trial. And that's where we went wrong. The respondent overreached. He went step one for the exclusionary order, and that overreach is step two. That's where we get to the adverse inference, and that's where we went a step too far. And the bright-line rule that's been set forth or has developed, it's not called a bright-line rule, but it's very clear that the issue is...
Where is the rule that says that a party has to be present? The lawyer is there. The lawyer represents the party. What rule says the plaintiff has to be sitting in court throughout the trial?
That does not exist. We could not find any authority that requires a party to be present at trial. But it's inherent in our system of justice that should a party want to testify in her case for her cause, that she should be given that opportunity. And And she wasn't given that opportunity in this case. While there were statements made in voir dire that she wasn't going to testify, first of all, the record, and of course, trial counsel is not here today, so we're forced with what's in the record. But according to the trial counsel's statements, he was testing a potential trial strategy that his client may not testify, and he wanted to test that out in voir dire and see what the jury's potential reaction was going to be to that. So the mere fact that it was stated in voir dire doesn't mean it was an election. And even if we assume that it was an election, that at that point she had somehow elected not to testify, which nothing requires a party to elect or not elect to testify at the beginning, but assuming it was an election, nothing prevents her from changing her mind. And circumstances changed in this case. That morning of trial, the judge issued a series of evidentiary rulings, one of which was that her husband was not going to be permitted to explain her absence. And things changed, and she should have been permitted to come in and testify. And the record indicates that she was trying to get to court. She couldn't meet the deadline. Her attorney asked, can she come in after opening statements? A reasonable request. That was denied. She arrived and remained in the courthouse throughout trial, even though she wasn't allowed in the courtroom. And she was present for her offer of proof. But she was never allowed to take that witness stand.
Opposing counsel, I think, indicated he had some concern that her absence would be used to create the effect she was afraid to come in because she was afraid of his client and didn't want her using coming and going to create sort of a false sense of lack of security, on her part or fear on her part. Is there another way that could have been addressed other than what the court did?
I believe so. There are a couple ways that could have been addressed. First of all, certainly there could have been a limiting instruction. The judge could have given an instruction to the jury that you're not to infer anything about the plaintiff's absence throughout the rest of trial, even though she only showed up for opening, or I'm sorry, only for her testimony, that has anything to do with any of the facts or damages in this case. Another option would have been a respondent could have sought that exclusionary order. If he thought that was going to be so prejudicial, he could have sought the exclusionary order. But what he couldn't do is step two. He couldn't go to the adverse inference. And that's the problem in this case. I will concede that if there wasn't the adverse inference and my client was just excluded, we'd have a much tougher appeal. Now, we would still argue it's an abuse of discretion to exclude a litigant because she only wants to show up for her testimony, but that's a closer call. But what makes this a clear error is that we had that adverse inference on top of it.
Was there a motion in limine to prevent your side from arguing why she wasn't or discussing why she wasn't present for
the
other parts?
There was no motion of that type. From the very beginning, respondents' counsel pushed and pushed and pushed, first of all, for dismissal of prejudice, and second of all, for sanctions against the attorney. And then third, he wanted her excluded from trial, and he wanted his adverse inference. I mean, he went for the highest level. And look, we can Monday morning quarterback this all day long, and that's the problem, is that we're sitting here today guessing about whether or not my client was going to come in and testify. And the reason we have to guess is because of the exclusionary order. If we don't get that exclusionary order, if that's not entered, we know whether or not she testified. Trial would have gone forward, and she either would have or wouldn't have. And respondents' counsel would have been right if she didn't testify to go up there before closing argument and say, Burnett and Pasternak, we get an adverse inference. It's very clear.
Well, the offer of proof, did that just involve whether she wanted to be present or whether she would have testified?
The offer of proof recorded what her testimony would have been had she been allowed to testify.
Okay.
And it didn't indicate, she did explain in there that she didn't want to testify, that she wasn't crazy about testifying. But, and that's, I think that's also a key point. Many times throughout the record, trial counsel says she doesn't want to be here, she doesn't want to testify. I think it's a very, very dangerous thing to infer that if someone doesn't want to testify, that they're not going to testify. Because no one really wants to come into a courtroom and testify. That's not an enjoyable endeavor. But to make that leap, that logical leap, I think is a very dangerous thing. It's something that is inherent in our system of justice, that a party be given that opportunity. She just wasn't given it in this case. Now, I'd like to address the practical effects of the court's ruling in this case, because I know this court is mindful of how its decision will be implemented by the lower courts. The problem is, if this case is affirmed, we create two uncertainties. First of all, it'd be the first case where we permit an adverse inference after an exclusionary order. So now we've got this case where, I guess, under certain circumstances, we can allow an exclusionary order and an adverse inference. That has not been allowed yet by our lower appellate courts. Certainly this court has not addressed it yet. But the second uncertainty that it creates is a very fact-specific inquiry, because what happens in the next case when the judge allows just a little bit less time for the client to get there? What happens when the attorney's words in voir dire aren't exactly the same? What if he just says she probably won't testify or she may not testify? What happens if the plaintiff doesn't show up to voir dire, but she does make it to opening statement? Is that enough to say that she voluntarily? So the problem is it creates this difficulty on trial judges who are making these decisions quickly under a lot of pressure. The flip side is, if we reverse and remand, we uphold, we confirm this bright line rule. You can have one, you can't have both. You can't have that exclusionary order and the adverse inference. It's simple, it's straightforward, and it's fair. This is all about fairness. You can tip the scales if you feel that it's unfair. If the response counsel felt it was unfair for her to come in just for a testimony, and you want to seek that exclusionary order, we would disagree with it, but maybe that's an argument that...
Explain to me, now, in a criminal case, I understand excluding witnesses because they might hear the trial and other witnesses that might help form their opinions, and so you might exclude witnesses in criminal cases until it's time for them to testify. What's the basis for excluding a party from a trial?
Well, that is...
What's the rule that allows you to do that?
That is a very good question, Your Honor, and I don't think Respondents' Counsel cites any authority for that, and that is part of the problem. I have great respect for Judge Schieber. I've been in front of him many, many times, but I think a confusion or possibly a misstep in this case was that this idea that a party has to be present throughout the case or she can be excluded, and unfortunately, there's simply no authority for that. There's just no authority.
Well, throughout courtrooms throughout the United States, corporations are being sued all the time, and they may not have a corporate representative. They have a lawyer who represents them in court.
Exactly, and that's one of the examples I made in the Western District, Your Honor, is that it's very common, actually, especially in a small business setting where you might have an owner that's needed to run the business. If it's a two-week trial, that owner can't be there sitting at the table all day long, and we don't say, well, he can't testify when it's time because he wasn't there for the whole case. There are certainly instances, and whether it's certainly this is a disputed fact, but my client's version of events is that she was ran off the road by this guy, and then she was followed down to Mexico for her wedding and had her nuptials videotaped. She was a little intimidated by this whole situation, and if she wanted to choose, you know what, I don't want to sit next to this guy for a whole week, I'm going to try to summon the courage to come in and testify, that was her choice.
Counsel, now wait a minute. In the hour and 20 minutes that they debated this at trial before the court issued its order, can you point me one time where anybody told the judge that that's what she wanted to do? Come in and testify and leave.
Well, I don't know that it's... And I'm sorry, could I respond? I see I'm out
Please.
Of time. I don't know that it's said in so many words.
Okay. Did anybody ever tell the trial judge that she wanted to testify at all?
Well, I think what the trial attorney says is that I'm going to put this in front of her. I know she doesn't want to be here, but we're going to have to see how this plays out. And I think what happened was you see a clear pivot, a change in strategy, a change in attitude of plaintiff's counsel once he realizes the husband is not going to be able to testify. In fact, I think at page 185 he says, Judge, I had no idea you were going to keep all this out. This changes the entire case. Please allow me, you know, some time to get my client here or allow her to enter after opening. I mean, I'm going to have to convince her to come in and testify.
It was all about whether she could be there. But I'm asking you whether there was any discussion in that context about her wanting to testify as opposed to be present in the courtroom, which is what everything had been talked about up until that time.
Well, I don't know that there's a set election. And again, I don't think there was any requirement. And that's another thing.
Was she listed as a witness in the witness list?
Well, and that's a good question. I don't think that is part of the record, whether there was an official witness list. And actually, in talking to attorneys, I think in Jackson County there's some dispute about whether or not a witness list is technically public or has to be disclosed or whether or not it's just for the court to plan trial. I don't see a specific witness list in the record, but that goes to the whole idea that there's no requirement that you elect or not elect to testify at the beginning
of trial.
When
was the offer of proof made as to her testimony?
The last day of trial, the very end of trial is when the judge allowed it.
You speak of a bright line rule that if you're going to have the exclusionary rule, or if someone's going to be excluded from trial, that an adverse inference can't be raised. Would it be permissible if someone is excluded from trial? And I agree with the Chief Justice. I'm not sure under what circumstances you would exclude somebody. Could the adverse inference rule be argued in closing argument?
If the party had already been excluded?
Yes.
I would say no. Because if you've excluded that person from testifying, you have not given them the free choice about whether or not to testify or not.
If they've voluntarily not been there, you could argue it.
Correct. And that's what Burnett and Pasternak already tell us.
But not until closing argument.
Correct. That's correct, because otherwise you would have no way of knowing until closing if the person was voluntarily going to testify or not, because we don't have this requirement at the beginning that, you know, elect whether or not you're going to testify now and forever let it be your word. We don't have that requirement.
The basis of the trial court's ruling, was it that the trial court didn't want a circus-like atmosphere? Was that part of the ruling or was that part of the argument?
Well, I believe the judge does allude to it in his ruling that he...
And was there anything in the record to support that other than him anticipating that?
No, Your Honor, there is not. There is no indication that my client... I struggle from the record to imagine a scenario where a circus atmosphere is created by a party entering and leaving. But there's no indication of something that happened prior in the case or some specific instance that was articulated as to what circus atmosphere was going to be created by the party coming and going.
You'll have time for rebuttal, and there'll be more questions, I assure you.
Thank you,
Your Honor. Your turn.
Mr. Pinnicup, I'll ask you the same question. Was there anything in the record to support the trial court's determination that she had to be excluded to keep order in the courtroom?
I wouldn't say anything directly regarding her. I think there are things in the record, however, regarding the conduct of plaintiff's trial counsel. And I want it to be very clear, Mr. Burmeister was not plaintiff's trial counsel. But immediately preceding this discussion, and just to go back, the original case had been mistried because of slides that had been shown to the jury improperly in opening statement in violation of Judge Schieber's order. Immediately preceding the discussion of whether or not Ms. Bear, now Gibbons, would be allowed to come in and testify or would be allowed to attend based on the conduct, there was a discussion of slides again, and there was a misrepresentation by counsel. And I believe
but that
the
doesn't have to do with the party being able to be present. I understand why you might have been upset with counsel, but that should not affect whether or not a party gets to be present during their own case.
I understand that. I think that's correct. I think we were discussing sanctions and the movement for sanctions. That was related to conduct of counsel regarding the slides as opposed to the issue of the party being present. The two issues became somewhat intertwined, and I was trial counsel. I was there for that entire argument. But again, knowing what the judge was thinking.
The judge became fed up, and that may have influenced how concerned he was about these issues. But is there any case that says a client has to be there for voir dire or opening statement or cannot be there for the rest of the trial?
There's no case that talks about the attendance of a personal injury plaintiff or any plaintiff that I could find.
Is there any case that says you can, in opening, use an adverse inference, or is this a first impression issue?
I think it's a first impression issue on the adverse inference. I think it's a first impression issue because we have a unique situation in voir dire in which voir dire, as has been said, is used to test strategy. And in this sense, plaintiff's counsel asked the entire jury panel in voir dire, would there be a problem if my client doesn't show up? And that's the question that was given, and people raised their hands or didn't raise their hands. And the next statement, not a question, but the statement was, well, she isn't going to show up. She's not going to be here. And once the plaintiff's attorney steps back.
How is that binding?
Well, as far as binding, I mean, I don't know what we would say by binding, but I would think that when a plaintiff's attorney makes a statement directly to the jury, you've stepped into a similar spot that you would be in opening or closing argument.
So you're making a statement to the panel. In closing, responding makes a difference or not. She said she wasn't going to be here, and by God, she showed up. We can mention that in closing argument. Let's see, for whatever worth it, whatever good it is, I mean,
I'm not sure what the effectiveness of her saying, of the counsel saying she wasn't going to be here, but she decided to show up. I mean, I don't know where that is.
You understand the questions. Did this just go too far, maybe because of the other issues that had come up in the trial? Did the court abuse its discretion in refusing to allow her to attend and in allowing you to
draw an adverse inference after refusing to allow her to attend?
Not at all. Under the circumstance of the case, I think Judge Schieber acted appropriately and, in fact, used some restraint in attempting to discuss this. I think based on what had happened earlier, he certainly had justification for dismissal of the case with prejudice, that that had been the direction he would have wished to gone. Now, when he went to this issue, I think it was completely separate. I think it had to do with his idea of controlling the courtroom and having proceedings that had previously been impacted by either misrepresentations or mistakes that were always in the favor of the plaintiff, and he wanted to make sure that this case went forward as best he could in an appropriate manner.
Did the judge, because of those actions, refer to the lawyer for discipline, or did he do anything? Did he do sanctions? What did he do?
Not that I know of. I did not make a separate motion for sanctions following the opening statement. As far as the judge took anything, I'm unaware of anything that has gone on. I have not followed that. It certainly did not happen within those proceedings, and if anything happened beyond that, I'm unaware.
Could he have excluded her from the courtroom if she were there because he was upset with counsel?
I would say, based on the it would be unfair to exclude her attendance at a continuing trial based on misrepresentation. Mm-hmm. However, it would not be unfair to hold her to her word after counsel had already made a representation to the entire jury panel as to how this case was going to be prosecuted.
What law supports that statement?
Well, there's no law in any of this
There's no law that a person who says my client isn't going to testify in Fort Dyer can't change their mind.
As far as whether or not they can change their mind, there's no law discussing the statements of counsel regarding the jury panel. Obviously, a mistrial could have been issued at that time if the judge felt that simply the statement was going too far, somehow poisoned the panel so the jury would be ready.
Why is that a good rule to say if you make a statement in voir dire, you're stuck with it the rest of the trial and you can't change your mind depending on what happens?
Well, I don't know if it's always a good rule in every circumstance. It may not be. But in these circumstances, when you're talking about the conduct of trial and you're talking about the conduct of witnesses and what's to be impacted, because the second half of the statement was, and there will be an explanation. Now, counsel said.
And then when the court said, no, the husband can't offer an explanation, why would they be stuck with their statement? I'm not clear.
Well, I believe that the court understood as I believed plaintiff's counsel understood that the type of evidence that he was attempting to admit in court was simply not the type of evidence that's normally
admissible. I'm not saying that ruling was wrong, but why would it, you haven't cited any authority yet. We're trying to find out what's the basis for saying that was not an abuse of discretion. When counsel decided, his client decided they wanted to be present, why was it and not an abuse of discretion to let him there? You're saying because he said an opening in voir dire that she wouldn't be, and we're saying so why does that matter? What do you rely on?
There's no authority discussing that, Your Honor.
So what principles? You're asking us to create an authority. On what basis should we do that?
Well, I don't think we're creating authority. I think the judge has the inherent power in the courtroom to determine how the lawsuit is tried within the parameters of the conduct of both the parties and counsel in the case.
What about this? And maybe when the trial judge made his decision, he was right. If the record, kind of following up on Judge Wilson's question, if the record up to the point that she made the offer of proof appeared that it was just a strategy decision that counsel had the right to make, suggesting that he wasn't going to call her to testify, maybe the decision was right up to that point, but once the party themselves showed up and made the offer of proof, then at that point the trial judge doesn't have to wonder whether or not she wants to or is willing to testify. She's made the decision, and she says she has the right to testify, so she's willing to make an offer of proof on that point. At that point, doesn't Judge Schieber have to reevaluate his decision and determine whether or not it was correct? And really, when we're looking at whether or not it abused his discretion, it's at that point, because even up to that point, he could have changed his mind. It might have made things messier for everybody. But it resolved the issue of whether or not she would or will testify, because she did.
Well, I think the Judge Schieber had a valid concern about, because of things that happened prior in the case, and not all by her, but other folks involved, that we were creating an atmosphere that would not be conducive to getting a fair and level playing field in front of the jury.
What does that have to do with her being present in her own case, though? I mean, you're not saying he could exclude her because he was worried about that from her own case. You're saying he only could do it because she wasn't there for voir dire and opening statement.
No, not just because she wasn't there for voir dire and opening statement, but I think in looking at the entirety of the record, when you consider the fact that, for one, she had stated through her counsel, she hadn't stated this, I should say, through her counsel, she stated that she was not going to be there. And then the next step was, how is she going to appear in the courtroom after she said she's not going to be here? Well, she's going to show up, presumably, according to this tactic that the judge felt they were going to use, presumably she would show up in an attempt to create additional sympathy by coming in and saying, I'm here. I have overcome this great barrier to testifying in court. And in fact, the plaintiff's attorney even argued to the judge that an element of her damages was the fact that she had to seek legal redress in the first place in court.
Well, of course, since she wasn't permitted to testify, we don't know if she would have said that. And the court could have controlled when she came in and made sure she didn't do it in the middle of testimony.
And that would not appear in front of a jury that I was fearful for coming in. That'd be in front of the judge. The jury would never hear that.
Well, my understanding is I don't know what plaintiff's attorney was thinking, but plaintiff's attorney had made the argument and was discussing in voir dire and speaking in voir dire in front of the entire jury panel that, in fact, she shouldn't have to be here at all, and the idea that she and not in the sense that she didn't have to be present, but she shouldn't have to be here to prosecute her cause of action. In other words, this is such an egregious situation, she shouldn't have to go to court to prove her claim.
I interrupted Judge Stitt's question, so you can answer Judge Stitt's question. Judge Stitt had a question.
Addressing the second aspect and a key aspect of what opposing counsel is focused on is the adverse inference, getting past what we've just been talking about. How can you argue an adverse inference from her not being there when the court ordered her not to be there? Our cases are clear in other, certainly this context has never occurred, but there's no prior case. All our prior cases say you cannot do that.
I think this is not a situation that probably will ever come up again. And I think what the judge was faced with was a plaintiff and an attorney who was willing to speak to the entire jury panel and claim that she's not.
I'm talking about the adverse inference. Nothing they did. How did that justify an adverse inference? If once he ordered her not to be there, how could you then allow an adverse inference to be drawn from that?
I believe what Judge Schieber stated was he believed that in this situation she made a voluntary election not to testify, and by allowing the adverse inference in opening statement, this is something that would be able to be talked about throughout the case in both opening and closing as a result of her not appearing there. And I believe that was his reasoning. And I believe on the second or third day of trial, he explained that was his reasoning as to why he made that.
She was sitting outside the courtroom the whole time, though, from the first day, right?
I don't know. Some people said that she was. The judge actually said on the record that that's actually not accurate. I don't know whether she was or not. I was inside the courtroom the whole time, so I don't know.
Sure. At the time of opening statement, the trial court that you first started arguing the adverse inference, the court had ruled that she was excluded from the case. Is that right?
By the time prior to opening statement, right. The judge made that ruling.
Right. So you made the many references to her not being present after there had been a ruling that she was excluded from appearing in court.
Correct. There was an instruction from the judge directly that, based on this unique situation and the fact that she would not be allowed to come here, that you could and should use the use the adverse inference in opening statement, which is obviously atypical.
Well, how's that any different than filing a motion in limine to exclude evidence, winning it, and then in closing argument, gilding the lily, saying why they didn't even. They could have said this, but they didn't. It seems like to me it's very akin to those cases where you file a motion to exclude the evidence, which may be a discretionary ruling on relevance,
that the judge gives you, and then in closing argument, you point out that the other side didn't bring in this evidence, which you purposely got excluded. How's it any different than that?
I think the difference being that the basis of the ruling was her election not to be there, and the fact that she was not present in the courtroom means that, unlike an argument on evidence, which would turn presumably on the admissibility evidence under the law, she had the opportunity to be there. She had the opportunity not to tell the jurors.
Well, she didn't once he told her she couldn't.
Once the trial had started, he did make that ruling. That's correct. But the difference would be that at some point, unlike an evidentiary ruling, that this evidence either should come in or it shouldn't come in, she could have had complete control over that simply by being there, according to the judge, as opposed to an evidentiary ruling, which would be this evidence is either unfairly prejudicial or it's not admissible under the hearsay rule. Whatever the reasoning is, that reasoning is different because she would have complete control over that. The opposing counsel could not take that away from her.
After the first day, did the trial court tell appellant's counsel that he would revisit this issue, would reconsider it the next morning if he brought authority for why the trial court ought to do that?
Yes.
And the next morning, did appellant's counsel say that the issue of her appearance and being allowed to participate was all water under the bridge and he wasn't going to pursue it?
Absolutely. Well, I see that my time is nearly up. If there are any other questions from the panel?
No further questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
You may rebut.
Respondent's counsel references his seeking a fair and level playing field. I would contend that there's nothing fair about excluding a party from trial and then getting to tell the jury that she chose not to take that chair, she chose not to take that chair, referencing counsel table. Everyone in that courtroom besides the jury knew that she had been excluded from court. It's not fair. It's unfair. It's unfairly prejudicial to allow that to go on in a courtroom.
Can you address Judge Wilson's question about the trial court raised this issue before the second day of trial? And what did counsel say, and was that a waiver?
Well, I know what is being referenced, the water under the bridge. First of all, that was said by the judge. Apparently it was, I guess, an off-the-record discussion where this water under the bridge statement was made. And the problem is, I don't know in what context that was made. But certainly the issue had already been preserved for appeal
Saying the damage had already been done by that.
The damage had already been done at that point. You know, the argument had already been made in opening, and I believe at some point in discussion with respondents' counsel, it was asked why didn't Judge Sheba readdress this before closing and realize that, you know, a mistake had been made. That was
according to the judge that I cured him. He said, "Well, I know I made that decision before, but now I'll let her testify."
He could have, and that would have raised some new issues in that.
May have raised more issues, but it may have also resolved some issues.
It could have resolved some issues because then what we would have is a clear answer, did she testify or not? He opens up the doors and he says, here's your chance. Are you going to take it or not? Right. And if she takes it, then we can address those issues with the adverse inference that was allowed in opening. If she doesn't, then we're probably not standing here today. And that choice was not given. That choice was taken away. And my client came all the way down here with me from Kansas City to ask for that chance. She wants that chance to testify. And she and I are asking for a remand for a new trial to give her that chance. You know, the big issue here is choice. That's what's been taken away in all of this, the ability to change one's mind. And I know the judges up here today have experience in trial matters, and all of us know that there's no blueprint to try a case on. It's not a static process. Things change, things develop. The best trial lawyers are those who think well on their feet because things change. And that's what happened in this case. Things changed, and it became very clear that my client had changed her mind and wanted to testify, and that choice was taken away from her.
And when the court, the water under the bridge statement by her counsel, her trial counsel, when did that occur? It was in an evening off the record. Was that after the first day of trial or the second day of trial?
I must plead ignorance at this time. I would have to look at the record, whether it was after the first or second day. I know it was in the middle of trial. I know it was after opening, and it was well before closing. At some point, there was this reference to this conversation. But again, the conversation itself is not on the record.
But the court put it on the record.
The court did put it on the record, right. The court was certainly documenting its reasons for why it was doing what it was doing.
It had the right to do that.
Certainly it did.
I mean, that's what happens if their conversation's off the record, then they are put on the record later, which is what the court did.
Correct.
And the court said, Ms. Gibbons' counsel, that if he presented case law that indicated the court had exceeded its authority, the court would revisit the issue and allow her to participate. And her counsel then said that was all water under the bridge and counsel wasn't going to pursue it further. Are you saying other things happened later during the trial that is contrary to that asked the court to revisit it?
Well, certainly, yes. Before closing argument, there's a long discussion, and that's where the cases are cited, including Calvin. In fact, many of the cases we cite in our brief were cited by trial counsel before closing argument, saying, look, here's the authority. We're really going astray of existing case law by allowing this adverse inference when my client has not been allowed to testify.
And so the revisiting the issue may have been with regard to her being present in court, but it wasn't with regard to allowing an adverse inference.
Well, it was discussing both. It was discussing both of those things, both the whether she was going to be allowed to testify, and then if you aren't going to allow her to testify, then you can't allow the adverse inference.
And what was the context in which she made the offer of proof?
The context was that the plaintiff's counsel, it's probably not in the record very clear as to why the offer of proof was being made.
What I was asking, what was in the record regarding why the offer of proof was made?
The record is not clear as to why plaintiff's counsel sought time to put her testimony on the record. My guess is, if I had to guess, was that he wanted to err on the side of having her testimony in the record so that if it came to this point, we would know at least what she was planning on testifying about.
Was that at the time that this issue was re-raised and the cases were cited, or when was that done?
Yes. It was just before closing arguments. It was the very end of the trial. Her offer of proof was made. And then the discussion ensues where, again, plaintiff's counsel moves to not allow an adverse inference in closing. And he says, look, you let it go on in opening. I thought it was wrong then. I raised it, but it still went on. Now I'm citing you cases showing you very clearly that this is still improper, and we move again to not allow an adverse inference, and the judge denies that.
My question I didn't ask directly was, in making the offer of proof, did her counsel say, I want to present my client's testimony. You've excluded it previously. Or because you excluded it, we agreed I was going to make an offer of proof? Or was there anything that tied making the offer of proof to the court's ruling on excluding her testimony?
Yes. I mean, that is what the plaintiff's counsel explains as to why he wants his client's testimony to be at least be on the record, is that, look, if she's going to be excluded from testifying, I at least want to get this down on the records to preserve it for appeal.
Thank you very much. The case will be taken under submission, and the court will be in brief recess.